Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Professor Is In podcast. I am Kel Weinhold, and I am an academic productivity coach. I work with you to build a healthy relationship with your work.
And I am Dr. Karen Kelski, the founder of the Professor Is In and the person who works with the editing team and who manages the social media and helps you negotiate your offers and all of those things. And as always, we're very happy that you're here with us today. We're glad you found us in the massive, crowded forest of podcasts that you elected to spend time with us. I think that's really cool.
And if you find this podcast valuable, if you find the work that we do useful, we would really like to invite you to support the podcast by becoming a podcast premium member over on our cool little podcast premium member site on Mighty Network. And you can join us for $3.99 a month. And when you do that, you get access to the topics that we're going to cover. And so you can ask us questions about what you'd like us to cover. You get to watch us record the podcast. And you get to be involved with after the show kind of things where we talk, where we do Q&As about the topics and AMAs about all sorts of things. So to do that, go to bit.ly/TPIIPod, as in P-O-D podcast. So bit.ly/TPIIPod, and it'll take you right to the link to become a member.
Yes, thank you for doing that, because as we've explained, and we'll keep explaining for a little while until it becomes totally redundant, we had to switch platforms, and instead of getting paid to do the podcast, we are now doing financing it all entirely ourselves.
Right.
And so having some subscribers is going to allow us to actually continue doing that.
All right, so in a break from our last several podcasts where we have been engaging with the ever painful conversation about leaving the academy, we are going to switch now to some actual practical advice for those of you who are still trying to get a job in the academy or anywhere. Actually, we're going to talk today about how to handle Zoom interviews, and we're going to talk about it really as it relates to the academic job market, but it relates to anybody. I can tell you that because I do a lot of these. I tell you, if you learn how to do this, you learn my secret methods, you'll win.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
What's the most important thing about the job interview? Do you know, Karen?
I think I do.
What is it?
It's that the job interview is not, and the whole application process, is not about who you think it is. Because you think it's about you, the applicant. It is not. It is about them.
Yep.
The hiring committee.
Yep.
They have a problem. Whether it's Starbucks or whether it's an endowed chair at Harvard, they have a problem. They need a warm body to solve the problem for them. They have defined the problem in the job ad, and they are hoping that you are that warm body. And so all of the particularities of your hopes and your dreams and your emotions and your feelings and your good intentions and this and that are not germane to their decision about who's going to solve their problem best.
Absolutely. And I hear people often in the first round, prior to the edits of prepping for interviews, talk about, well, this will be really great for me because I'll be able to continue research in this area, or you have this institute, museum, collection, group of people who are doing what I'm going to do so I can continue doing it. So there, you know, you exist in this place and I want to live here. I mean,
my family lives in Cambridge.
Right.
When applying for a job at Harvard.
Because
Harvard cares about that. But not just Harvard. This is not just an elitism thing.
No.
Please don't get distracted on that example, although that is a real life example. It just becomes more visible when we give an example like that. But it truly does not matter. Again, a job at Starbucks at your local shopping center, exact same thing. What your goals are is not their priority.
Right. Maybe we could switch off something like Starbucks and move on to corporate job. But okay, I get your point.
What's wrong with Starbucks?
Because I think nothing's wrong with Starbucks. I think maybe you're right. Maybe it's a way to get people to remind people that, in fact, it's just a job interview like any other job interview.
I like to do that. But, yeah, I mean, I agree that most of our listeners are probably, by dint of education and class, achieved class, if not original class status, are probably not going to apply for jobs at Starbucks, but you never know. But, yeah, like any job, let's say a nonprofit that you decide to go for.
Right. I want to,
you know. Or a federal job, federal research job that you decide to go for.
I've always wanted to study, you know, X, or I've always wanted to help with this is not grounds to hire you. Because basically, here's the thing, folks. And the way I hear it most of the time is people say, well, this is a position looking for, I'll just make up a field, a biochemist who studies blah, blah, blah. And I'm that. It's like, and so is everybody interviewing. So if you don't add words, if the words don't add to your value in this, why you should be picked, then you're kind of off the mark to start with.
And that's a slightly different issue. Right. So we've moved on now to kind of the second issue, which is if don't state the obvious. And I have a blog post that's called Don't State the Obvious. And it's basically like if anyone can say it, it serves you not at all.
Right.
So anyone can say, I'm a biochemist with a specialization. We went way out of my area of expertise, I can't even make one up. But, you know, if anyone can say that they are that thing, then saying it is unhelpful. But also, I'm a passionate teacher. Well, that's just an unsubstantiated emotional claim rhetorical claim. And so that anyone can say it, so it doesn't help you.
Right. If it's and I feel that way about adjectives. Not only can anyone say it, but they have no meaning. Mm-hmm. They have a meaning for you, but they don't have a meaning for anybody else.
I'm excited about this job. Anyone can say it.
Right. So we titled this, you know, surviving the Zoom interview or engaging in a Zoom interview. I also want to put that over. I want to really emphasize the wasted words things with Zoom. Mm-hmm. People are exhausted.
Yeah.
They're tired of looking at the screen. They're tired of absorbing information digitally or whatever we're calling this thing. And so if you waste words, if you say things like I'm a passionate teacher and you don't have any evidence of that, if you don't have evidence, then you've wasted words and you're just sort of pouring sand on a table that you're trying to get people to find a gem in. Mm-hmm. So especially, and I coached this before Zoom interviews, but I really coach it now. Mm-hmm. Get to the fucking point because nobody has any bandwidth.
Yeah.
So I don't want to hear you go on for 3 to 5 minutes about your research.
Right.
And I know that some people out there are telling you to prep a 3-minute statement on your research. Do you know how long 3 minutes is to sit and listen to somebody on Zoom about something that you really don't care about? Mm-hmm. So really critical that you get as every sentence is as rich as possible.
And let's just make a note of that they really don't care about, because then some of you are like, but of course they care about. You're so anti-intellectual right now, because of course the search committee cares about my research, but I'm going to parrot what you always say. I hear you always saying, which is, let me ask you this, dear listener. When you're out for drinks with your colleague and that colleague starts, and this is whether you're a grad student or assistant professor or tenured professor, and that person starts talking about their research. Oh God. Well, first of all, you have to imagine being out for drinks. I know. Let's just do that as a intellectual
in the before exercise. Times.
The before times. How long did you listen for? Now put it on Zoom. How long would you listen for?
All right. You're all getting together in a group. You're going to say, hey, let's get together for
like
Zoom
party.
Beverages and, or even not cocktails hour. If you don't drink, but you're all just getting together as a social. And you're all like, how's this? How's that? And somebody starts saying, well, I want to listen, really, give me the seconds, because it's going to be seconds that you're going to listen. And
so remember that the search committee is feeling quite the same way. Right. They do want to hear, if they asked you, tell us about your research. Yes, they do. They have asked that question. That's legitimate. But the answer you give is going to be, when I do these, you know, help people, I coach to 6 sentences.
Yep.
I don't know how many minutes that comes to.
It's not long.
Is it really?
No.
But yeah, 6 sentences. And when we say 6, we mean 6.
Right.
And then we sketch out what is in each of those 6 sentences. We don't need to go through that in the podcast because we have so much other information in my book, on the blog, in our pre-recorded webinars on that, unless you want to.
No, I don't want to.
But it's basically like remembering the problem that the search committee has defined that they need a warm body to fill is part of that problem is that they need a research specialist in blah, blah, blah. So yeah, you're going to quickly sketch that you are that specialist.
But they also want to know what method you use, because mm-hmm. the thing I would say is when you're listening to your colleague drone on about their research, I make the argument that the vast majority of people are listening for methodology. Mm-hmm. They're listening to see, could I do that? Mm-hmm. Could I apply that to what I'm doing? Mm-hmm. They're not even listening to content. It's like, right. but wait, how did you do it?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, you did, you know, semi-structured interviews. Oh, you did Ooh. A regression analysis. Ooh. Oh, you did. Wait, what chart did you use? Where did you get your data?
Right.
Not like I care about, you know.
What archive?
Yeah, exactly. So it's really, that's mm-hmm. where everybody perks up. So,
that's true.
But the really cool part of that is that also in an interview talking about your research, when you talk about your methodology in one sentence, you reveal what you can teach.
Mm-hmm.
So you serve the purpose of saying, mm-hmm. so to pursue this question, mm-hmm. I, you know, gathered 5,000 names from the national database on X, and I ran this kind of regression, and then I did this kind of analysis. Mm-hmm. And
sitting there thinking, ooh, she can teach our methods class.
Right. Yay. You can teach quantity.
Because that's
you can
the
teach
other
stats.
Part of our problem that we right. did, in fact, mention. Sometimes they don't mention that.
Right.
So there are also secret problems right. that they have that right. they did that didn't make it into the job ad. Right. But every department needs someone who can teach quantitative methods in your field, your hypothetical field. Let's say you're a
qualitative methods
or ethnographic methods or, you know, whatever.
And you folks out there who are telling me we notoriously don't have a method, just be quiet. That's not possible.
Literature folks, you have a method. You
philosophy.
Just don't. Philosophy.
You
yeah.
can't. You did not just sit in the middle of an intersection and have a thought.
In a field.
And say, you know, I think that this is the definition of existence.
Yeah,
you right. read things. You compared things. You did analysis. You said, I'm going to take this philosopher and this philosopher. Right. You were a continental philosopher right. or you were a... I just forgot the other one. Analytic.
You work drawing from, and this is actually, thank you for bringing this up, because I was sitting here though noodling on something, which is in some fields, the term might actually be better termed as theory, because in some ways yes. theory is method,
yeah.
especially in the deep humanities, right. because
or in people who are theorists.
Or people who are theorists, but it's also, so because I was thinking, like, I was hearkening back to, like, when I would listen, and sometimes when you listen to someone and they're talking about some project they did in Latin America, like, I'm an East Asian, I studied Japan, so I'm not going to, like, relate to the Latin America stuff or a lot of the content that they're talking about, but if they did a feminist analysis, mm-hmm. then I'll be like, oh, those questions they're asking are so interesting. And if I transfer them to Japan, they would help my project as well. And that's more of a theory mm-hmm. than mm-hmm. a method.
Right.
So in some
ways,
it's
still a way you're approaching it.
It's a way you're approaching it. Right. And so that's why philosophers, yeah, you guys have a method/theory, theoretical foundation, and you can talk about it.
Art historians, I'm talking to you too. Even if what you're doing is taking five paintings that were created during the Meiji era, I'm trying to think of an era in Japan, mm-hmm. right? And you're looking at those paintings and you're looking at the use of blue.
Mm-hmm.
You're examining the use of blue in those paintings through a theoretical, artistic, whatever lens, you're right. actually doing the analysis, and that is method. It's a close reading. It's actually the very definition of close reading.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Okay.
Whoa, we digressed.
Was, yeah, and we went on this long digression. Sorry if you guys all just sort of went and got a drink of water.
Here they go. I just wanted to know how to answer the research question.
But that is because, please understand, it's because we're so aggravated because this problem arises so often.
But I'm aggravated for a very different reason. I feel
aggravated?
Like the failure of humanists,
uh-huh.
the people in the humanities, the failure to claim a method decenters them as real scholars and mm-hmm. puts the humanities at threat. And that if you started to claim that you had a method
yeah.
and that you were equal to any physicists out mm-hmm. there saying, no, we're applying mm-hmm. actual critical mm-hmm. analysis to this. Then right. Mine's just much more like, stop saying that.
Right. But the thing is, they say it from a kind of snobbery. They do.
I know
this. As a humanist, I'm entitled to say that it's a kind of a snobbery. But the trouble is, it's a misplaced snobbery, because what it's doing is it's kind of retrenching or entrenching this like ivory tower esotericness that is actually harming the standing of the humanities in a real political economy of higher ed, in politics, like the fact that, it's a lie. Of course, it's a lie. It's gaslighting. It's annoying, but it's mythologizing. But also, you know, we humanists could be having an impact on politics far greater than we have mm-hmm. if we embrace some of this language.
Well, and we may be, maybe having it, but it's not, you're not getting credit for it.
Yeah.
It's happening. The humanist perspective informs a bunch of stuff, but there's no credit. It's not like saying this.
Zoom interviews, but I just want to say that I put a thing on Facebook a few minutes ago on The Professor Is In that was a book review of a new book. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the book and the author. I'm really sorry. God, I suck as a humanist. I'm the worst humanist.
What are you going to tell them?
Well, it's a new book and it is about, so that narrows it down quite a bit. And it is German history. And
okay,
post-war history.
Okay, narrow.
And it is written by a woman, and it is about the appearance of magic mm-hmm. in Germany after World War II. Mm. Well, both preceding, but mostly after. And it was in that moment of self-reckoning when they had to deal with the fact that the Nazis had happened, that magical thinking took over. Here's why this matters.
I'm waiting.
The book review made a clear and obvious parallel with our present times, that in times of great national peril, turmoil, where your self-definition has shattered because evil has arisen, however you define that evil, like we different sides define it differently, you fall prey to magical thinking. And they made the parallel, the QAnon, and the vaccine's going to kill you, going to implant a chip into you that the government's going to survey you with, and all of this crazy. This is magical thinking.
Interesting.
Yeah. So anyway.
Okay.
Oh my God, we've gone really far off the rails.
Okay. So I'm just going to go. I'm just going to put a stop sign and say, listen, when you talk about your research, you want to say what you're looking at, how you looked at it, what you found, what you argue, why it matters. Mm-hmm. That's it.
And also, I would say who funded it.
Yeah. I never have people say that. Mm-hmm. So that's just, okay. So.
And by the way, if you were like, wait, that was too short. Please know it's in my book. It's on the blog. It's in our intervention webinar recording that you can access at any point whenever you want it.
Yeah, it's the details are there. I'm not going to go through it here. I was looking for.
Okay, so what else about Zoom interviews? So, about eye contact? Are you willing to go to some practicalities that?
I do want to do that, and then I want to go back to how to structure any answer that will save you on Zoom. So,
okay.
but back to the Zoom interview. Here's what I notice is that people don't pay attention to where their eyes are in relation to the camera. And now I'm not talking about the way people look away and all of that, but I've done several practice things this last couple of weeks where people start talking to me and I say, where are you looking? And they're like, well, your face is up here. I said, but where's your camera? Well, it's right here. So move my face under the camera. Drag the image so it's under the camera. You don't want to be staring at the camera like the little green light, because you'll start to just sort of lose. It'll be like Mr. Peabody in those old cartoons. Ah, you lose purchase, right? You need to see the person.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You need to get that picture there. If you have a Dell laptop, when they were still putting the camera on the bottom right of the laptop, mm-hmm. you've got to get either a different computer or you have to put your computer up on a pedestal that's way higher than you think, because otherwise the camera's looking up your nose.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a person who does multiple screens,
I was going to mention that,
and you have your camera over on your right-hand screen and you're looking at them in the center screen,
they're
seeing the side of your
face.
They're
seeing the side of
your face. Like, actually test it out. Like, go use the free Zoom account, turn on start meeting, and keep adjusting everything till you look good in it. Adjust the light. Notice the, you know, that the book right behind your head says sex and power. If that's what you want to have there, great. If it's not, move it over. Mm-hmm. You know, notice where there's a weird, you know, line in your bookshelf or a shadow or whatever. Go test it out. Right. Everybody can have a free Zoom account. All you have to do is do start meeting. And then you just keep messing with stuff till it's like right there. Then learn how to get rid of your own picture on Zoom. So put it into gallery if that's what's necessary. Do what you need to hide your own picture, because we stare at ourselves. We do. It's just so, that means our eyes are always flicking off to the side. Right. And we're not looking at the people we're talking to. So that's like that basic, like, get it together. Mm-hmm. We have a post on the blog about lighting. That guest post from someone who wrote all about how to light for Zoom or for an interview. Yeah. So go read it and apply it.
Yeah, it's terrific. And we have, back in spring when the pandemic started, we did some crowdsourced advice about Zoom interviews that remains fantastic.
And that's so under our...
That's Dispatches.
Dispatches so from the front lines.
If you look at our hashtag Dispatches series and go back to April, May, you'll see some wonderful compendiums of advice about this.
And a lot of people have got this dialed in because they've been teaching on Zoom, right? They figure out, this is my little area, this is this. A lot of people kind of panic in the face of that and think, oh no, now I have to come up with a blank background or I have to do this. And if you want to see, if you want to just get a really good laugh about backgrounds, go check out Leslie Jones on Twitter, the comedian Leslie Jones, and look at her reviews of backgrounds on CNN, because they just, they're just hilarious. And they'll start to show you like, oh wow, I thought that was okay, but my weird plant over there, maybe not okay.
Or Room Raider.
Room Raider's
on Twitter,
also great.
That's quite funny.
But anyway, so that's just the you've probably already done it with your classes, but really to think about what is it that I'm presenting here. A lot of times I ask people, are you in a basement? I mean, is this a basement room?
People are weirdly distracted by backgrounds.
Yes.
And that we shouldn't be. I mean, I will agree with you that if you're doing an interview, your attention should be on the person, not on the room they're sitting in. But it's some kind of weird thing. I don't know. It's a, it's deep. It's very deep. It's this curiosity.
Right.
And so you do, I just want to tell you, just be aware. You can't get around this. They're going to be peering, trying to read the titles of the books behind you. They are. It's like some weird thing. So
but more,
make sure.
But I was going the other direction. If you're in, if you put yourself in front of a white wall, like you're in some
that's
kind
also
of gulag,
extremely,
it's very strange.
It's very strange and it's very off-putting.
Right. I was doing a group work with a group the other day, and one of the people in the group had switched to a new location, and it looked like she was in some kind of basement. And I said, you know, have you been kidnapped? Do you need to blink if you're okay? Because this is very strange. You're normally in this really nice space.
Right.
And there was a perfectly good reason for it. But I think that we need to pay attention to that.
Yeah.
So the other thing about the interview and Zoom is physicality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a 2D environment.
Mm-hmm.
And we want normally in an interview, especially the campus interviews, you would be able to use your body and you read their bodies as a way of interacting. So you have to figure out how to, in a way, overcome that barrier, which is extremely hard for so many academics, so many people. But really, academics, the more stressed you get, the more closed down that you get.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So number one, make sure that there's more in the camera than your face. The number of times I work with people that it's just like
a
their
face.
It's like, could you back up? Keep backing up. Back up.
Okay,
some more.
But our very literal listeners are going to be are going to panic now. Like, well, what's the right amount? And I would say it's your just the top of your shoulders.
No, I would say it's mid chest.
Are you serious?
Yeah, because otherwise, where do your hands come in?
Oh,
you
wow.
need your hands to you need your body to move.
Wow, that's okay.
Right. All so right. If I'm looking at you and you're answering me and you're top of the shoulders mm-hmm. and your head.
Yeah, you have to put your hands up here to gesture, which has been weird.
Right. And what Karen did is put her hands up next to her ears like she was Minnie Mouse or something. But think about, like, how can someone see you shift, move, gesture, mm-hmm. and how so what is a comfortable thing? And so think about, I mean, again, fake Zoom. Get a few people on Zoom. Start, have them have.
Yeah, you can all help them, each other. Yeah, so it's like, a mutual aid
ask
society.
Me a question.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, it's really weird. You're super stiff. Oh, wait, that's way too much. You're way too far
now
back.
Now you're moving. Now your head is bobbing back and forth right. In a really distracting way.
Get rid of your rolly chair.
Yeah. Which is both moving too much and noisy.
Right.
Here's another thing. What do you wear? I was doing a Zoom interview intervention with a client we started doing it, and she said, damn, I thought this blouse was the most perfect interview blouse, and now it looks like, it looks like I'm wearing a paper bag. And it was sort of like a ecru silk blouse, button-down blouse. And, of course, this theory of a silk blouse, we all love a silk blouse, right? Like, ooh, we're fancy now. Except that silk blouses have a terrible tendency to sort of flap around you, to kind of collapse around your neck, and they don't hold a collar. And she did. It did look like she was sort of wearing this weird paper bag. And so what she thought was the most perfect interview wear was actually quite bad. Also, the color did nothing for her. It washed her out. So you have to think about the color
with
you're
Zoom
wearing.
With Zoom lights and everything else. Zoom so you lights. Can look in the mirror and say, wow, this looks great.
That as well, yeah.
And anybody who has any photography knowledge, and people learn this really the hard way, a white shirt does not read well. Mm-hmm. So if you put on a white shirt for an interview, it's going to throw off the camera so much in trying to deal with all that white that you're going to end up washed out. You're going to end up disappearing. You're going to end up with no features. There's a whole bunch of stuff. So what's behind you, what you're wearing, how it reflects up. So don't count on your mirror to determine what you're wearing. Count on your Zoom and your light.
Yeah.
And do you have a light ring that you can adjust the tone? And if you don't, you know, are you going to put a lamp behind your computer and have it face up, not right at your face, so you don't end up like looking like, again, dear like you're headlights. Being interviewed by, you know, 15 detectives. Like, so
think about warm and cool colors that people are doing. I mean, if you like that, you don't have to if you don't want to, but I tend to like that. And then, of course, jumping from there to what some of our listeners dearly love and others hate, which is makeup and hair.
Right.
And what are you doing with your hair? What are you doing with your jewelry?
Right.
And does it look good on Zoom? Because just because it looks cute in person does not mean it's going to look good. And actually, what I find being a person who loves jewelry or who loves makeup is that I wear a lot more makeup on a Zoom situation than I would wear in person.
And I will tell you, I spend a lot of time on camera. It's winter, so I'm pale. I'm stressed, so I'm pale. I have overhead lights in my office. I have a window to the side of my desk. And this week I realized I had to move a screen over the window because the window light is so harsh that I look half dead no matter what, because the lighting, I cannot get the light to adjust. Mm-hmm. So I actually have the color that's in my skin. I know.
Such as it is.
It's winter. I'm pale. I'm very white, whatever, but I have tonal color in my skin. And instead I just look like every time I look at the camera, it's like, oh my gosh, I look like I didn't sleep. And I'm just about to die.
Right,
so pay attention to that in advance. Uh-huh. Back to the physicality thing. Pay attention. Think about the fact that the video is a flat image, and a lot of people have trouble interacting with it. How can you, in your mind, make it a full image? How can you look at those people and think, they're right across from me? And how would it change how you moved and talked? Mm. How does it warm up your voice? Mm-hmm. How does it shift you forward when you want to say something, which is why you don't want your face right up there, because you shift forward out of enthusiasm and then you're like, you know, an eyeball the screen. So really, how can I imagine that we're in the same room? And even that imagining will help you.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Right?
Put you in a different mindset.
When I work with people who are seriously anxious, I have them imagine that they're with their favorite person in the before times in a pub and they're just answering questions. Mm-hmm. And so I have them practice. Like, you're talking to your cousin. You're talking to your cousin. Cousin just asked you, you know, what's your plan for your research? Mm-hmm. And that means that you keep your body a little looser. Mm-hmm. You keep your tone a little warmer. You keep your affect less, you know, this memorized thing. And you create a conversation. Yeah. And that's so critical in a Zoom interview, that you work on creating that ambiance and conversation.
Yes.
So let's see. What else? What else do we want to talk about?
I'm aggravated because I had a really good thing to say and then it fell out of my brain. And so I'm just sitting here blinking at you, kind of half panicking, because I know conversationally I should pick up the slack and I can't remember what it was I was going to say.
Too busy chasing an idea instead of...
It was really good.
Right.
But, and it, you know, it's all these... Cats. That was my idea. So I actually interviewed one of our current professors and editors, the editorial staff, who I really broke, you know... this rule, because she has a cat who's huge and very domineering and basically crawled all over and basically stood on her head the whole time, if not on her shoulder or her lap or behind her staring at me from on the sofa, the entire interview. And it was so distracting. But of course, a professor is in editor interview is, I would like to think, a kinder, gentler, and less intense interview scenario than a tenure track search committee. So yeah, you don't want your cat coming across the screen.
Well, and I guess that we're in COVID, right? What do we do? I mean, I've been making the argument when I've been talking to people in all the groups I coach, look, we're just going to accept the domestic is going to interfere with the professional. That's just the reality of our lives right now. That means your kids are going to make noise, all that sort of stuff. With that said, the more you can contain those distractions, not for the listening audience, but for you.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to talk and explain your research and you can hear your kid screaming, or you can, you know, the cat is howling outside the door, any one of those things. And I know that there are structural limitations, right? I know some people don't have someone to take the kid for a walk during the interview. And I know that sometimes you may live in a place where you're not allowed to go for a walk, or someone, you know, your cat may just be, you know, you may have a studio apartment. I saw a great New Yorker cartoon that said Zoom prep. It was a picture of a, you know, there's a computer, the back of a computer, and then a guy taping his cat to the wall. I thought, there you go, right? So, you know, maybe your cat needs to go in the bathroom with the white noise machine on, or you can take your other computer and turn on white noise. I mean, keep thinking about it, and not because, oh no, I'm not going to get the job if my cat bothers me, but I'm going to not be able to concentrate if this is happening. So try to create a space where you feel like it's just about you. Like you get for that 30 minutes, folks, it can be just about you within the context of the limits of your life. Take as much push as you can. You know, if it means that your partner has to go sit in the car with the cat for half an hour.
Right.
Okay.
And the cat's furious.
And the cat's furious
on the floor when it gets back in. Like, whatever. Like, just, you know, do what you have to do.
Right.
So inconvenience people and animals to the degree that's
so you can have the space to be able to think.
Yeah.
So to reiterate, the question is not the question. So make sure that you understand what they're looking for.
Oh, you didn't actually say that.
Well, I guess, it's the subtext.
You really didn't. You did not say that. So that you should probably say that. Are we out of time?
Well, it's okay. I do this too much, right? So it's already written into what I said without saying it. When they ask you about your research, they don't really want to hear all about your research. So the question is not the question. It isn't explain all your research to me. It's put your research in context to this department, to the methods we're interested in, and the way that you think.
To prove that you solved the problem that we've communicated.
Right. So concise answers that you get to the point. Creating an environment where you look like you want to be looking, testing it out, trying it.
Well, I was just still thinking about all the ways people go south on basic questions, like how would you teach X class? How would you teach Y? Name a class, you'd describe a class, you would develop for us. All of these content questions are answered. I mean, our advice for you is there. So basically just building on that, the question is not the question. You so often misunderstand what they're asking.
I have a blog post called The Question Is Not the Question.
And it's just, it's hard to articulate briefly. But basically, you know, you think that they want to go into the weeds of your thinking around a certain class. And it's like, no, they don't want to go in the weeds. You're going to bore them. You're going to lose them. they want a quick five-sentence summary that goes through the topic, the texts that you're going, the readings that you're going to use, the quick structure of the class, beginning, middle, end, and a sample assignment, and then how it fits into the larger curriculum that they offer, the, you know, the
right,
the scaffolding of the classes in the major, and boom, you're done. That is five sentences. You are done. And so oftentimes that's where the question is not the question. They don't want what you think they want. They want something quick and concise.
That touches on all the important things that they need to know.
This person knows how to comport themselves in a classroom. We're not going to need to worry about that.
Right. So it gets back to that. So this has been, we went down two different tracks repeatedly here. We went from like, here's practical advice to here's the way to conceptually think about it to practical advice. And that's really basically how to prep for an interview, right? You have these practical questions and then there's this whole ethos, mindset, whatever. So I'm going to give you one last piece of information to think about every answer that you give. I don't care whether it's, why do you want to be here? How would you teach this class? What's your five-year plan? Every answer needs to be structured like a middle school essay paragraph. Topic sentence, evidence, 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 conclusion. Why are you interested in this position? I'm interested for several reasons. Let me tell you my connection to the department, the people, the programs, the classroom. That's why I applied. What? Tell us about your research. Largely, I do this. My project, I did this. These are the methods I used. This is what I found. This is what I argue. This is why it matters. There's your conclusion, right? How are you going to teach this class? When I teach this class, this is what I'm trying to do. There's your statement. Now I'm going to tell you the text I use, the topics we cover, the assignments I give, and what they're going to have at the end. What they have at the end is the conclusion. Every single answer is, here's the answer.
Middle school essay.
Here's the answer. It's not developed enough to stand alone, but here's the answer. Here's the proof. Here's it wrapped up. So if your answers are not structured like that, you're talking too much for a Zoom interview.
Amen.
All right.
All right.
That's it.
See you next time.
All right.